This context highlights the importance of the 1920 to 1921 Depression. Here, the government and the Fed did the exact opposite of what the experts now recommend. We have just about the closest thing to a controlled experiment in macroeconomics that one could desire. To repeat, it's not that the government boosted the budget at a slower rate, or that the Fed provided a tad less liquidity. On the contrary, the government slashed its budget tremendously, and the Fed hiked rates to record highs. We thus have a fairly clear-cut experiment to test the efficacy of the Keynesian and monetarist remedies. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we're getting into one today. We're getting into a read today that I've been wanting to hit for a while. Just because it came up a couple of different times. There was specifically a Twitter thread not too long ago. Not too long, in the realm of like 3 months or 4 months. And I made some sort of a claim around the Great Depression or whatever in like a conversation with a couple of Bitcoiners, or I stated a fact that I assumed was common knowledge in Bitcoin, particularly around the history of the Great Depression and what caused the Great Depression. And I was immediately challenged. I'm like, well, that obviously, how could you just dismiss the entire argument with that? Like, how could, you know, you have to defend that. And I was just surprised because I assumed it was common knowledge. And not to take away from the other person, like, I don't think anybody was disingenuous or unfair in the argument. It was just something that I expected not to have to explain. For example, that one of our highest debt to productivity ratios in the history of this country was immediately before the Great Depression, and that the Great Depression was a fallout from a massive amount of unsustainable debt. Whereas there are still a number of people who would argue that, you know, deflation and like these other things were bad and they were causes and things that harmed or helped the negative outcomes of the Great Depression. And again, I was just kind of taking it for granted that we had sorted that one out. And then in addition, I really haven't gotten into economics. I mean, we talk a lot about major economic theories and just kind of simple fundamentals that, like, I'll explain through story or analogy a lot on the show, but I haven't hit an economics piece in a pretty long time. And this one is by Robert P. Murphy, who I am a big fan of. He's on the Tom Woods all the time. In fact, he fills in for Tom Woods on the Tom Woods show often when Tom Woods is not there. But in general, he is a brilliant economist and also very entertaining. I will have links in the show notes to check out the other writings and stuff that he's done on fee.org, as well as Mises, just so that you can follow him and check him out on all the different platforms. I should reach out to him and try to get him on Noster. But this article is posted on the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE.org. I am a massive reader of their website. They have such a great Austrian economic foundation to the overwhelming majority of what they publish, and always just really great insights. So I highly recommend that resource as well for anybody who likes to dig into these types of topics. So with that, I just want to thank our amazing sponsors. That is the Fold Card, and the Fold app for giving me sats back on everything in my life. For Swan Bitcoin, the best Bitcoin onboarding and automatic savings account that now has the Swan IRA. If you have a savings and retirement, you've got to check out Swan Bitcoin. And then, of course, CoinKite and the Cold Card and their many hardware and security devices that keep my Bitcoin and my sats safe at the end of the day. They all make this show possible. Keep the lights on. Keep me hydrated and fed. And they are also basically the center of the services that I most use in my Bitcoin life. And as someone who has filtered through like all of the services and wallets and the things, I feel like I'm a pretty good resource. So, you know, check them out. Links, goodies, discounts, right in the app, in the description of this podcast episode. It's like, right, oh my God, it's so close and convenient. Check it out. And now, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, The Depression You've Never Heard Of, from 1920 to 1921, by Robert P. Murphy. When it comes to diagnosing the causes of the Great Depression and prescribing cures for our present recession, the pundits and economists from the biggest schools typically argue about two different types of intervention. Big government Keynesians such as Paul Krugman argue for massive fiscal stimulus, that is, huge budget deficits to fill the gap in aggregate demand. On the other hand, small government monetarists, who follow in the laissez-faire tradition of Milton Friedman, believe that the Federal Reserve needs to pump in more money to prevent the economy from falling into deep depression. Yet both sides of the debate agree that it would be utter disaster for the government and Fed to stand back and allow market forces to run their natural course after a major stock market or housing crash. In contrast, many Austrian economists reject both forms of intervention. They argue that the free market would respond in the most efficient manner possible after a major disruption, such as the 1929 stock market crash or the housing bubble in our own times. As we shall see, the U.S. experience during the 1920 to 1921 depression, one that the reader has probably never heard of, is almost a laboratory experiment showcasing the flaws of both the Keynesian and monetarist prescriptions. The 1929 to 1933 Great Contraction. Despite what many readers undoubtedly learned, quote-unquote, in their history classes as children, Herbert Hoover behaved like a textbook Keynesian following the 1929 stock market crash. In conjunction with Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, Hoover achieved an across-the-board 1 percentage point reduction in income tax rates applicable to the 1929 tax year. Hoover didn't stop with tax cuts to bolster aggregate demand, though analysts at the time would not have used the term. He also signed into law massive increases in the federal budget, with fiscal year 1932 spending rising 42% above 1930 levels. Hoover ran unprecedented peacetime deficits, which stood in sharp contrast to his predecessor, Calvin Coolidge, who had run a budget surplus every year of his presidency. In fact, in the 1932 election, FDR campaigned on a balanced budget and excoriated the reckless spending record of the Republican incumbent. It wasn't merely that Hoover spent a bunch of money. He spent it on just the types of things that we associate today with Roosevelt's New Deal. For example, he signed off on numerous public works projects, including the Hoover Dam. Of particular relevance today is the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, or RFC, established under Hoover, which quickly injected more than $1 billion to prop up troubled banks that had made bad loans during the boom years of the late 1920s. And this was when $1 billion really meant something. It is true that Hoover eventually blinked and raised taxes in 1932 in an effort to reduce the federal budget deficit. Today's Keynesians point to this move as proof that reducing deficits is a bad idea in the middle of a depression. Yet an equally valid interpretation is that it's horrible to hike tax rates in the middle of an economic disaster. After the bold tax cuts pushed through by Andrew Mellon in the 1920s, the top marginal income tax rate in 1932 stood at 25%. The next year, because of Hoover's desire to close the budget hole, the top income tax rate was 63%. Given this extraordinary single-year rate hike, it is no wonder that 1933 was the single worst year in U.S. economic history. For what it's worth, the fiscal year 1933 budget deficit was still huge, coming in at 4.5% of GDP. Despite the huge rate hikes, federal tax revenues only increased 3.8% from fiscal year 1932 to 1933. So we see that the standard Keynesian story, which paints Herbert Hoover as a do-nothing liquidationist, is completely false. Yet Milton Friedman's explanation for the Great Depression is almost as dubious. Following the stock market crash, the New York Federal Reserve Bank immediately slashed its discount rate, how much it charged on loans, in an attempt to provide relief to the beleaguered financial system. The New York Fed continued to slash its discount rate over the next 2 years, pushing it down to 1.5% by May 1931. At that time, this was the lowest discount rate the New York Fed had ever charged since the establishment of the Federal Reserve System in 1913. It wasn't merely that the Fed, along with other central banks around the world, was charging an unusually low rate on loans it advanced from its discount window. The entire mentality of central bankers was different during the early years of the Great Depression. Writing in 1934, Lionel Robbins first noted that during previous crises, the solution had been for central banks to charge a high discount rate to separate the wheat from the chaff. Those firms that were truly solvent but illiquid would be willing to pay the high interest rates on central bank loans to get them through the storm. Firms that were simply insolvent, on the other hand, would know the jig was up because they couldn't afford the high rates. Yet this tough love was not administered after the 1929 crash, as Robbins explained. In the present depression, we have changed all that. We eschew the sharp purge. We prefer the lingering disease. Everywhere in the money market, in the commodity markets, and in the broad field of company finance and public indebtedness, the efforts of central banks and governments have been directed to propping up bad business positions. We therefore see an eerie pattern. When it came to both fiscal and monetary policy during the early 1930s, the governments and central banks implemented the same strategies that the sophisticated experts recommend today for our present crisis. Of course, today's Keynesians and monetarists have a ready retort. They will tell us that their prescribed medicines, deficits and monetary injections respectively, were not administered in large enough doses. It was the timidity of Hoover's deficits for the Keynesians, or the Fed's injections of liquidity for the monetarists, that caused the Great Depression. The 1920 to 1921 Depression. This context highlights the importance of the 1920 to 21 Depression. Here, the government and Fed did the exact opposite of what the experts now recommend. We have just about the closest thing to a controlled experiment in macroeconomics that one could desire. To repeat, it's not that the government boosted the budget at a slower rate, or that the Fed provided a tad less liquidity. On the contrary, the government slashed its budget tremendously, and the Fed hiked rates to record highs. We thus have a fairly clear-cut experiment to test the efficacy of the Keynesian and monetarist remedies. At the conclusion of World War I, U.S. officials found themselves in a bleak position. The federal debt had exploded because of wartime expenditures, and annual consumer price inflation rates had jumped well above 20% by the end of the war. To restore fiscal and price sanity, the authorities implemented what today strikes us as incredibly, quote, merciless policies. From fiscal year 1919 to 1920, federal spending was slashed from $18.5 billion to $6.4 billion, a 65% reduction in 1 year. The budget was pushed down the next 2 years as well, to $3.3 billion in fiscal year 1922. On the monetary side, the New York Fed raised its discount rate to a record high 7% by June 1920. Now, the reader might think that this nominal rate was actually looser than the 1.5% discount rate charged in 1931 because of the changes in inflation rates. But on the contrary, the price deflation of the 1920 to 21 Depression was more severe. From its peak in June 1920, the consumer price index fell 15.8% over the next 12 months. In contrast, year-over-year price deflation never even reached 11% at any point during the Great Depression. Whether we look at nominal interest rates or, quote, real inflation-adjusted interest rates, the Fed was very tight during the 1920-21 Depression and very loose during the onset of the Great Depression. Now, some modern economists will point out that our story leaves out an important element. Even though the Fed slashed its discount rate to record lows during the onset of the Great Depression, the total stock of money held by the public collapsed by roughly a third from 1929 to 1933. This is why Milton Friedman blamed the Fed for not doing enough to avert the Great Depression. By flooding the banking system with newly created reserves, part of the monetary base, the Fed could have offset the massive cash withdrawals of the panicked public and kept the overall money stock constant. But even this nuanced argument fails to demonstrate why the 1929 to 1933 downturn should have been more severe than the 1920 to 21 depression. The collapse of the monetary base directly controlled by the Fed during 20 and 21 was the largest in U.S. history, and it dwarfed the fall during the early Hoover years. So we hit the same problem. The standard monetarist explanation for the Great Depression applies all the more so to the 1920 to 21 depression. The results. If the Keynesians are right about the Great Depression, then the depression of 20 to 21 should have been far worse. The same holds for the monetarists. Things should have been awful in the 1920s if their theory of the 1930s is correct. To be sure, the 1920 to 21 depression was painful. The unemployment rate peaked at 11.7% in 1921, but it had dropped to 6.7% by the following year and was down to 2.4% by 1923. After the Depression, the United States proceeded to enjoy the Roaring Twenties, arguably the most prosperous decade in the country's history. Some of this prosperity was illusory, itself the result of subsequent Fed inflation, but nonetheless, the 1920 to 21 depression, quote, purged the rottenness out of the system and provided a solid framework for sustainable growth. As we know, things turned out decidedly different in the 1930s. Despite the easy fiscal and monetary policies of the Hoover administration and the Federal Reserve, which today's experts say are necessary to avoid the mistakes of the Great Depression, the unemployment rate kept going higher and higher, averaging an astounding 25% in 1933. And of course, after the Great Contraction, the U.S. proceeded to stagnate in the Great Depression of the 1930s, which was easily the least prosperous decade in the country's history. The conclusion seems obvious to anyone whose mind is not firmly locked into the Keynesian or monetarist framework. The free market works. Even in the face of massive shocks requiring large structural adjustments, the best thing the government can do is cut its own budget and return more resources to the private sector. For its part, the Federal Reserve doesn't help matters by flooding the shell-shocked credit markets with green pieces of paper. Prices can adjust to clear labor and other markets soon enough in light of the new fundamentals, if only the politicians and central bankers would get out of the way. All right, that concludes Robert P. Murphy's piece, The Great Depression, or The Depression You Have Never Heard Of, 1920 to 1921. Robert Murphy is, he actually had a really great, he's an economist, and I've always been a big fan of him, and he wrote essentially a more common language version of human action. So if anybody knows Mises, Ludwig von Mises and human action as kind of like a cornerstone of Austrian economic theory and such a brilliant piece, well, anybody who's actually read it knows that Mises is hard to digest. He wasn't a native English speaker, but that really wasn't probably the big thing. It's just the way he words things and the verbiage he uses can be very difficult to consume. It's, you know, you have to think about some of his sentences or paragraphs really hard to kind of understand their meaning. Well, Robert P. Murphy has a great book called Choice, which is essentially a summarization. I wouldn't call it like a Cliff Notes or a summary. It's simply a better, a more common language explanation of the principles and arguments that he lays out and that Mises lays out in Human Action. So if you have not, I mean, if you want to dive into Mises's Human Action is absolutely the more comprehensive and the quintessential, you know, piece of Austrian economic history. But if you're looking to digest and kind of more lightly embrace those ideas, I definitely recommend Robert Murphy's book, Choice, is a really good one for that. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes. Really quick, though, let's go ahead and hit our sponsor for today. And then I really want to get into a guy's take on this piece, since we haven't really gone down the economics rabbit hole recently. 0.2 Bitcoin, specifically 0.195 Bitcoin. That is how much I have saved. I have essentially gotten for free by switching to the Fold debit card. I get sats back on literally everything that I purchase. And the Spin Plus card, the premium card that has higher rewards, only costs $10 a month. And I promise you that the amount of time that I have used it, that $10 a month doesn't get me anywhere near 0.2 Bitcoin. If I had just been buying Bitcoin, which actually I can do right in the app. If you stack sats, the Fold card is a huge, huge boost to your normal sat stacking. It is one of the best complementary sat stacking methods that I know of, and it is not hard to use. I know a lot of people are like, I switch my debit card and it's like a little bit different, and no, it is not. My mom uses it. Both of my in-laws use it. My sister uses it. Like, this is not a difficult thing. And even better is it's all managed right in the app. Like, I've been using it for a really long time, and it's really handy and far more intuitive than something like my bank account and my banking app. My old banking app just doesn't even know the first thing about UX. It is a very painful experience. But luckily, I don't have to deal with it anymore because I do everything with the Fold card. And even better, I get paid sats to do everything on the Fold card. This is the only way to do fiat, to get paid sats to have to deal with poverty paper. I mean, what better way to help account for fiat inflation than getting paid a tiny negative interest rate on all of the purchases that you make? I mean, I had to hold that fiat for like a short while before it turned into sats. I probably lost purchasing power, but if I make 1%, 2%, 3% back in sats, well, I'm getting paid interest. I'm getting paid interest in the hardest money in the world for having to use that garbage. And you can get 20,000 sats right out the gate just by signing up with my link. Signing up for the free account, by the way, not the premium. I mean, you should do the premium, but you get 20,000 sats just for the free version. Check it out at my link, bitcoinaudible.com/fold. It will be right there in the show notes for your convenience. So the first thing that this article hits that I think is really important for everyone to understand, just because our economic history is such a disaster. It's crazy too that, you know, I feel like I learned this in like middle school or like early high school, that Hoover was all about the free market, and then the FDR came in and saved everybody with government intervention. And if there was ever an example of a textbook literally lying to you, like just perfect, unmitigated, propagandistic bullshit, that is like a perfect example. Because there's absolutely nothing to support that statement, but it is common knowledge. Like, that is considered generally common knowledge because everyone is taught that idiocy in school. And there's nothing to back it up. In fact, there is a memoir from, I can't remember the name of it. I read this section, and I can't remember God, this is going to drive me crazy. It's a memoir of the top economic advisor of FDR that literally says in his memoir, like he details out, he says, we sold it as if we were challenging. And that's another thing too, is that remember that the political facade of everything that's going on, that like I'm different than the other one, is largely what gets written down in history. So like a great example is that like Bush and Obama are seen as two polar opposites, when if you took them away and you took any rhetoric of, you know, right-leaning or left-leaning, and you just looked at what they did, the actions they took, the wars they engaged in, and their deficits and all of these things percentage-wise, you'd have no idea that they were different. Like, in all meaningful context, they're the exact same president with the exact same philosophies. They just, one of them has a Texan accent, and the other one is like a all high and hoity-toity orator. And they both say the same drivel, like cultural drivel, that supports their side. That just makes the lowest common denominator of the left support Obama and the lowest common denominator of the right support Bush. But I guarantee you, for most people, for the overwhelming majority of people, anybody who is not extremely well-versed and very in-tuned with what each president actually did and actually cares about the meaningful things. If I just went through like a list of like the top 20, like the most significant things that they did, I guarantee you 99.5% of people would have no idea. They'd say the wrong person. And I actually think most would specifically get it wrong because they would attribute the negative things to the other party, when really both of them just did a whole series of just negative, awful, stupid government interventionist crap. But going back to the point I was trying to make, or the little trivia thing I was trying to bring up, was that the top economic advisor wrote a memoir and specifically said that the New Deal and the plans that FDR enacted were really just a repackaging and expansion of the exact same thing Hoover had been doing. Or more specifically, one of Hoover's plans. I think it was actually one of the things that he couldn't get done. And then they basically went on a political campaign criticizing Hoover and then basically finished enacting his exact plans after FDR got in office. Another great example of two people doing the exact same thing, but because they're on opposite sides of the aisle, everyone is convinced that they had to be different. But if you just zoom out, look at the size of the deficits and the amount of interventionism and the fact that they both, in whatever flavor, they both thought that government intervening and manipulating the economy was the solution to our economic problems. And the crazy thing is so crazy how stubborn or hard-headed we are to miss such a shockingly obvious truth. The New Deal is hailed as something that helped people and was a positive thing and helped us get out of the Great Depression, when it literally coincides with the Great Depression, like the worst depression, worst and longest persisting economic depression we have ever had. In fact, it's one of the worst across the world. Like, at what point do the actions taken and the results of those actions not have causal relationships? At what point do we watch the longest sustaining economic depression we have ever had and not connect it to what they were doing to fix it that wasn't working? And even better, that we have this perfect example of the exact opposite response. Like, that is what is so crazy about this, and what I love about this article, but also in just such a great example of how blindly arrogant politicians are, and also how confirmation bias and selfishness so deeply pervades everything that is politically funded and politically connected. Politics is literally the personification. It is the ultimate apex of society for normalcy bias, confirmation bias, and resistance to change. And specifically using the theft, manipulation, corruption, and violence of government to prevent that change from happening. And it makes perfect sense why politics is necessarily the dumbing down of every issue to the lowest common denominator of moron in society. And anything resembling meaningful or useful change is going to be rejected. It is by definition going to be abnormal, which means there is no solid way. It is going to have nothing but an uphill battle. And it's going to be weird. It's going to be foreign. It's going to be strange and stupid. It's going to be like Bitcoin. Unthinkable, absurd, ridiculous. And necessarily will have a vast uphill battle to beat itself into the psyche of the normal idiot who persist in doing dumb, terrible, self-destructive decisions that are reinforced and rewarded through the political system the more and more politics is infiltrated into society, because it becomes a tool to economically distribute confirmation bias rather than economic information. It becomes a tool of political distribution of economic resources rather than an economic system trying to translate the reality of values and resources that are actually happening in the real world. Going back to a great example is the use of knowledge in society. If you have not listened to and or read or heard any of the breakdowns and times where I talk about that piece, if you do not understand the fundamentals of what creates a price and how the market works, none of this is going to make sense to you, and it's going to sound like I'm just blurting out a bunch of claims. You've got to listen to and or read that piece and try desperately to make an understanding of what is happening, because a price cannot be predicted or manipulated. It is axiomatic to what a price is, what the price is the result of, such that no one can know it, because it is an aggregate of everyone's knowledge. Or not really an aggregate, it is a reflection of the outcome of the value stake decisions of everyone's individual knowledge. And which is exactly why you can't even have an opinion about a price except in relation to another price, which means that you are using the very mechanism you say you can fix as the foundation for explaining why there is a need to fix it in the first place. So this is the ultimate, the narcissism of politicians is that they can say, because they trust the price in one area, they can make a claim, they can make an argument against the price in another area of the economy, which is completely circular, because either the pricing mechanism is a problem or the pricing mechanism is the foundation by which we judge and value everything. And since everything is relative, everything is only a comparison. It doesn't matter if it's a billion trillion Zimbabwe dollars versus just a trillion Zimbabwe dollars that we're comparing, or it's $100 versus $10. It is all relative, and any price in one area affects the price in another. So when a politician says or argues, or an economist, a quote-unquote mainstream economist, says that because prices in this area are X, that we need to manipulate or intervene and make prices in this area Y, understand that as soon as prices in area Y are changed, it alters and affects the inputs, the production processes, the resources, and the labor that all go into making price X. Nothing in the economy is disconnected. As soon as a price in one area changes, it alters all of the economic decision-making of every single participant and all of the potential alternatives and how many steps they are removed from each other. Which means as soon as you change Y based on what you see it at X, you affect X. X changes. Which means you didn't affect the relationship. You didn't change the relationship. You just made both stop doing the job that they are trying to do, is give you relevant, useful information about what is happening in the economy. So anyway, it's a long way to say you should listen to The Use of Knowledge in Society if you haven't, because it is very foundational, and it is also amazing. I'll have a link to it in the show notes if you want to listen. So again, back to this actual article. The best thing about the 1920 to 21 situation and its response is that not only is all of the actions taken the exact opposite, the exact things that are claimed would cause utter disaster, but also the outcomes are the exact opposite. All of the things that they claim definitely wouldn't happen did happen. But I think it's also important to note just how much the mentality changed during that period. You know, this was shortly after the creation of the Federal Reserve back in 1913. And so really what we saw, the insane volatility, both in the debt levels and the degree of the manipulation, and then the examples of the 1920 to 21 collapse and subsequent recovery under Calvin Coolidge, which Calvin Coolidge is like the best president ever. And I appreciate, I commend Ron Paul for pointing me out to Calvin Coolidge to actually go down the rabbit hole one day, because Calvin Coolidge is absolute boss. But then also the massive debt explosion towards the end of the 1920s and the subsequent Great Depression and all of the intervention. It's so funny that if you actually look at it honestly, if you look at it from the Austrian perspective, it makes so much more sense. And it's such a perfect microcosm of all of the things that have happened since and why we are in the current problems that we are in, and just how much of a failure all of the established arguments and economic theories, so to speak, of what all caused and occurred during that period are such absolute nonsense. But this is where the foundation of economic thought took a huge shift in our history. And I also think there's a really good, important reason why. And I think it's necessarily the case when money becomes essentially such a completely political tool rather than something that emerges on the market. But let's go ahead and start with this quote. It says, "So the entire mentality of central bankers was different during the early years of the Great Depression." Writing in 1934, Lionel Robbins first noted that during previous crises, the solution had been for central banks to charge a high discount rate to separate the wheat from the chaff. Those firms that were truly solvent but illiquid would be willing to pay the high interest rates on central bank loans to get them through the storm. Firms that were simply insolvent, on the other hand, would know the jig was up because they couldn't afford the high rates. Yet this tough love was not administered after the 1929 crash, as Robbins explained. Quote, "In the present depression, we have changed all that. We eschew the sharp purge. We prefer the lingering disease. Everywhere in the money market, in the commodity markets, and in the broad field of company finance and public indebtedness, the efforts of central banks and governments have been directed to propping up bad business positions." This is something we've talked about a number of times in the past, and I like to reiterate, and it's totally lost on the average person. Economic contractions, economic downturns, and the subsequent restructuring that the market does based on the price correction is one of, if not the most important market mechanisms for making a sustainable, productive, robust economy. It is the ultimate filter to clean up the garbage, get rid of the waste, cut the fat, punish the irresponsible, the reckless, and corrupt business practices. Everybody makes money when there's nothing but green candles and there's nothing but growth. The dumbest, most reckless businesses can survive if there's continued growth, but they get demolished during the recessions and the contractions because they do not survive any sort of volatility. They cannot survive in the real world because they are not good business practices. It's like building 18,000 houses out of straw, and then a gust of wind or a half-decent storm comes through, and then subsidizing the rebuilding of all of these houses made out of straw because they all got torn down, and then wondering why the economy is so unbelievably fragile. This is what the government has done with our economy. This is what the central bank and our government have made part of their core philosophy. And reason for existence is to do everything possible to stop this from happening. And I love Lionel's wording here, because could there be a more perfect example of what has been happening over the last 20 to 30 years? We eschew the sharp purge and prefer the lingering disease. the efforts of central banks and governments have been directed to propping up bad business positions. And look at the result. Look at where we are today and ask yourself if all of the leveraged underwater banks, the reckless, gambling, speculative mentality of massive banking institutions in this country in 2007 and 2008 were let to be torn to pieces and sold off in bankruptcy so that we could actually stop that stupid behavior, if they actually paid the price for their idiocy, rather than all of the mortgage holders, rather than the taxpayer, where would we be today? Would they still be engaging in that practice to an even greater degree? Of course not, because they know they were committing suicide. And I think us as Bitcoiners have such a great example to show why this is important. FTX survives as long as we're in a bull market. Mt. Gox survives as long as we're in a bull market. Genesis, 3AC, Luna, the Terra Luna stablecoin disaster, it all thrives and can actually persist as long as we have nothing but growth. But the second there's a little bit of a downturn, they all die. They all implode because of their own stupidity, recklessness, and corruption. The dumbest of dumb shit coins goes up in price during a bull market. It is the recession that cleans them out, that actually establishes legitimate and worthwhile, robust business practices and punish the people who ignored or dismissed critical safety and responsible practices because they wanted to make some of that extra shitcoin bucks. It's one of the many reasons I always say bear markets are the best, because you get rid of those stupid companies. And I think on a long enough timeline with enough, and there's plenty of that culture left to clean out. And there's plenty of that culture still being supported, rewarded, and bolstered in fiat, in the fiat world, that is still going to spill over into the Bitcoin world. But understand, Bitcoin is sound money, and it is not sustainable in the Bitcoin space. And this process, over and over and over again during the monetization phase of Bitcoin, it is what is going to change the culture. It is what is going to change business practices. It is what is going to change finance and turn it from a leveraged speculative casino to something that is so robust, so liquid, and so collateralized, and has such a long-term perspective that it has to survive 70 to 80% drawdowns and recoveries. This is a feature, not a bug. Okay, and then there's another thing, and we've talked about this on the show as well, but and I will link to that episode, Deflation and Liberty, but this is another great quote that I loved out of this piece. It says, "But on the contrary," just talking about, obviously, the difference between the establishment, economists, academia, and political claim as to what will happen and then what actually happened. "But on the contrary, the price deflation of the 1920 to 21 depression was more severe. From its peak in June of 1920, the consumer price index fell 15.8% over the next 12 months. In contrast, year-over-year price deflation never even reached 11% at any point during the Great Depression." End quote. I cannot say this more simply, and this will be something that anybody who has gone through, particularly mainstream economics, but generally has learned anything about economics through, you know, political talking points, or largely anything in the public education, the public schooling system. I don't like calling it education because that's not what it is. But I will say this as simply as I can. Deflation, natural deflation, is not even debt deflation, is not bad for the economy. It is not bad for demand or investments or production or consumers. It is bad for debtors. The government is the biggest debtor of all. The reason academia and politics embraces Keynesianism and anti-deflation ideology as if it's the boogeyman of all boogeymans has nothing to do with scientific thought, logic, or legitimate economics. It is self-preservation, pure and simple. They are the largest debtors on the planet. In every economy, the government is the largest debtor. Out of survival, they demonize their greatest enemy, explicitly at the expense of the economy, explicitly at the expense of healthy investment, production, and consumer purchasing power. They defend their influence, their ability to consume, and their market power. It is not bad for the economy. It is exactly what the economy needs to heal from the damage the government and the political apparatus has done. It is pure, arrogant, selfish incentives that academia and government have fully embraced the anti-deflation argument. They simply want you to pay for their destructive behavior and overconsumption so that they can keep doing it. And I'll give you a simple analogy that this is kind of like an axiomatic thing about life. You know, it's so funny when you really think about what the government, what the political system and the propaganda around the government needs to intervene and deflation is bad, all of these economic policies and these economic theories, that nothing in life actually works out like this. That it just so happens to align that the only way out, the most important solution to all of these problems is to do every single thing that the government already wants to do. Consider deflation is the absolute worst possible thing for a government with too much debt. Having to cut spending is the worst possible thing for a government that wants influence, control, and to feel important. Interventionism is the best possible thing for a government that wants power and influence. And aggressive interventionism at the point of an emergency is exactly what is needed for everyone in society to turn and suddenly care about politics and hail politicians and economists as the center and most important heroes of our society. That literally across the board, not one thing that is the supposed solution to a major economic problem is actually being frugal. Is actually difficult, requires restraint, requires an honest self-reflection. No, it just so happens to 100% from top to bottom align with everything the politicians already want. So let me give you an analogy here. Imagine that you just want to do whatever you want, right? You want to eat whatever you want without much thinking about it. You don't really care if it's healthy or not. I want a donut right now. I would like a bag of Cheetos. And you know, you don't like that your spouse just talks to whoever they want to talk with. You feel like you really should control your spouse. You engage and act on your jealousy, on your pettiness. You control who they hang out with and who they talk to. And that you just want to do just generally whatever you want to. You drink pretty regularly because you feel like it. You're eating the Cheetos. You're watching Netflix. You're going out to the bar. You max out your credit cards buying whatever frivolous crap that you want to. Maybe a new 70-inch flat screen to watch more Netflix and a lifetime supply of Cheetos. You're doing all the easiest things and all the things that require you simply to indulge in the things that you want to begin with. Then some tensions really start to build. Some problems begin to manifest, and one day disaster strikes. Your spouse cheats on you, or you have a heart attack, or you get really sick, or you run out of money and you have a change in your job and suddenly your income doesn't support your debt. Just something really awful related to all of the wonderful activities you've been engaging in. What are the chances that a real honest solution just so happens to be doing everything that you have already been doing, but just a lot more of it? Instead of having a little bit of self-reflection, instead of turning and eating something healthy for a change, instead of going out and doing a little bit of exercise, instead of, you know, not embracing your basest desires and embracing every stupid, shallow thought and emotion and acting on it, that you have to self-reflect a little bit and you have to restrain and have an honest opinion and you have to judge yourself and realize when you've made a mistake and apologize for that. Instead of changing your behaviors and selling all of that crap that you didn't actually need and starting to save a little bit and paying off your credit cards and focusing on getting a better job and improving your life and making things sustainable and actually making good decisions and thinking about long-term consequences of the things that you are engaged in. No, none of that. None of these difficult things could possibly be it. It must obviously be that everyone else is wrong, and I just need to do all of the things I've already been doing a lot bigger and a lot faster and a lot more often. It just so happens, so astonishingly conveniently, it happens to be the case that all of the things government prescribe to get out of an economic disaster are also all the things that give them economic power, political influence, that stroke and nurture their narcissism and support their belief that society would utterly collapse without their holy guidance and majestic charity, and that let them throw all restraint out the window and go on a psychotic rampage for starting every committee, setting up all of the agencies, and pushing through the thousands upon thousands of subsidies and government programs and special interest payouts and every insane and frivolous stupid project that they ever hoped they could get money, government money for, to see their vision of the world come to fruition. That just so happens to be the solution to an economic emergency. What a coincidence. I want to hit one more quote before I close this episode out, because this is just such a great example of how much mainstream economic theory has to twist what actually happened in an effort to defend the bias they are already trying to create, or that they are hoping to find as a result. So let me hit the quote. It says, "After the Depression, the United States proceeded to enjoy the Roaring Twenties, arguably the most prosperous decade in the country's history. Some of this prosperity was illusory, itself the result of subsequent Fed inflation. But nonetheless, the 1920 to 21 Depression, quote, purged the rottenness out of the system and provided a solid framework for sustainable growth. As we know, things turned out decidedly different in the 1930s, despite the easy fiscal and monetary policies of the Hoover administration and the Federal Reserve, which today's experts say are necessary to avoid the mistakes of the Great Depression. The unemployment rate kept going higher and higher, averaging an astounding 25% in 1933. And of course, after the Great Contraction, the U.S. proceeded to stagnate in the Great Depression of the 1930s, which was easily the least prosperous decade in the country's history." End quote. This is such a... The Great Depression in general is such a perfect example of being given an absolutely astonishing and decade-long literal orgy of evidence, with the worst track record of any economic period in our entire history, to prove how much of a failure the government intervention was, with the immediate juxtaposition, barely a decade before, of seeing the exact opposite philosophy, the polar opposite, not like a little bit less, but the polar opposite philosophy, turn it around to the point that nobody even talks about the economic downturn anymore because it was so insignificant and short-lived. To look at that, to take those two situations and the response to them and see the results and think that government intervention was the solution to the economic problems is 100% nonsense. There could not be a stronger signal to its total and abject failure. And the establishment uses this as evidence that they did not embrace the theory strongly enough. Could there be a more perfect example to demonstrate the definition of insanity? To keep doing the same crap over and over again and expecting a different result? Again, I want to stress, we're not talking about like slightly bad results or questionable outcomes. We're talking about the worst results of any in U.S. history being used as evidence of exactly the opposite of what it should be proving. I think it's just a profound and fascinating example of showing just how much the narcissism and selfishness can always completely overpower self-reflection, honesty, and restraint when it comes to the political mind. And I refer to government and politicians and the political apparatus, but it's not really that. It's the political brain. It's the political way of thinking in all of our heads. Like it is an ideal. It is a way of thinking. And the zone of the political, the means of the of politic in interacting and making economic diktats and manipulating the economy and paying out subsidies and taxing people and punishing this area and subsidizing and benefiting special interests. Like the entire apparatus of the politic is a tool of confirmation bias protected by theft and violent enforcement. It is the instantiation and defense of what is quote-unquote normal through enforcement and manipulation when it fails to do so through merit. Consider that anything, any meaningful change, necessarily means that something is abnormal, that it is weird, it is foreign, like I said earlier, that it is specifically outside of the realm of what we are already engaging in. And more importantly, anything that we are engaging in that is wrong, that is widespread, but is a complete misunderstanding, a failure, a fallacy, whatever it is, then even worse, anything that solves it, that meaningfully presents a solution to it, is not only going to be seen as abnormal and foreign, but is going to be seen as stupid and crazy to boot. It's not simply going to have like a minor resistance to change, because it's also going to have to, it's going to require that everyone who has been making terrible decisions and terrible mistakes and engaging in stupid practices will have to admit that they are wrong and they've made a terrible, stupid decision. Like, do you know anybody who is happy about doing that? Happy about admitting that they've been a failure? It's got layers upon layers of pressure and resistance to do anything at all to not admit that we've made this level of mistake. The political apparatus is the instantiation of those mistakes through violent control and manipulation. It is the single greatest impediment to valuable change in society. It is selling power over society by marketing vice as virtue, and it is why it is so viciously and naturally against freedom of speech, against controversial opinion, competition, responsibility, and individual choice, because these are the things that kill mistakes. These are the things that reveal errors. These things are the control group in the experiment. And it is why it should be no surprise at all that this is the government response, that this is what benefits them, and that this is what they would reinforce, this is what they would teach, because every single incentive reinforces it. And this is why we will never solve it until we get money out of the hands of government. So enjoy the bear market. Enjoy the price crashes. Because if you are engaging in responsible behavior, if you have good practices, if you have good liquidity and collateral, you will survive with an opportunity to get more of the sound money and to come out the other end and in the next bull market 10 times better off than you were last time. and all the fools and the charlatans go out of business. They separate the wheat from the chaff. So thank God for Bitcoin that we have a way out of this, because it is certainly not coming from the government. With that, a thank you to Robert Murphy for really just all of the amazing work he has done. I've been a big fan of Robert Murphy for a really long time. Listened to him for I don't know how many years. I don't even know. Tom Woods was like really pivotal, like early on, because his show's been going on for a decade. I don't even know. A long, long time. And Robert P. Murphy was a big part of my economic journey as well. I learned a lot from him. So a huge thank you, and glad I got to do a read of his on the show. I don't think I've done one by him yet. Definitely check out his other stuff. I will have a link to his book. I will have a link to The Use of Knowledge in Society. That is by Hayek. I will have a link to Deflation and Liberty. And I will also have a link to all of our amazing sponsors. The Fold app, so that you can stack sound money just by using fiat with the Fold debit card. I will link to CoinKite so that you can get yourself a cold card and keep your sats safe from hackers and crappy security hole-ridden computers. And Swan Bitcoin so that you can get your retirement, your savings account, your long-term plan. You can learn everything and you can onboard all the people you know to a pure signal, responsible, sound practice Bitcoin company. Man, if that's not a lineup, you will find all of those goodies right in the description of this show. And I will catch you guys on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Thank you for listening. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Society is division and association of labor. In the final analysis, there is no conflict of interest between society and the individual, as everyone can pursue his interest more efficiently in society than in isolation. Ludwig von Mises.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.